Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining the Behind Company Lines podcast. Today we have Aaron Gray, President and CEO of FindHelp, the leading software platform for connecting people to social services in the United States. Aaron is so excited to chat with you and not only get to know your background and your experiences, but also kind of this increasing interest in connecting services to one another and connecting services or organizations who want to help people with their audience even more so. It seems like we have kind of most, if not all, the tools kind of there and all the information. There's a lot of government programs, but if the connection issue that a lot of people seem to face when getting the resources that they need, obviously we'll go and unpack what that means, what you're doing at FindHelp to kind of solve that problem. But before we get into all that, what were you doing before you started the company?
Well, first, thanks for having me, and I'm excited to be here. So before starting the company, I worked with the Texas Health and Human Services Commission as a contractor. So a lot of people don't know this, but Texas is growing quite rapidly, something on the order of 20% in population growth every 10 years. Wow. So it's a very large state, over 30 million people. But if you think about it, how do you account for the growth, that level of growth? And in particular, how do you account for that level of growth in something as complicated as a safety net? And I had a chance to work with the Texas Health and Human Services Commission as a contractor that worked exclusively on trying to solve the problem of how do you allow people in need to apply for services, government services online, like the SNAP program, the TANF program, aid in the Children's Health Insurance program, through a simplified, streamlined application, but also a call center that they could call so that they could get enrolled in services if they ever got stuck. Yeah. So that was a very exciting and interesting project. And perhaps probably the most fascinating life experience that I've had during those 4 years was the, if you remember in 2008, there was a financial crisis that happened quite rapidly in the summer. And what we noticed is that the call volume for the call center that the state ran was increasing dramatically every single month.
Yeah.
And my team at the time was responsible for forecasting those calls. And we were getting the forecasting wrong. And of course, everybody knows what happens now.
Right.
But what happened now? But we weren't really ready for it. And the enrollment in the SNAP program, food stamp program in the United States, increased so rapidly that many states were not prepared to even handle the paperwork necessary to get them enrolled.
Yeah.
So you ended up having a public safety net that completely broke down in 2008 and early 2009. And which meant people suffered. And then the question that was always nagging during those years was, what do you do when the public safety net doesn't work? And that's where I sort of started thinking about what we do today and how we might be able to help.
Yeah. And what do you think? Obviously, it sounded like there was this huge amount of paperwork that kind of just overloaded the system. But I guess it was there just a disconnect between those who were applying for the program and completing the process and the application to its entirety and just an overload on the services that were being provided to help them. I'm always curious when you apply for those programs, it seems like the requirements are, or even the information that they're asking is pretty in-depth and pretty detailed. And I guess I'm curious, why is that? Why do we need to have so much information? And is it still that way in terms of the barriers to actually get the resources you need? Because even with like taxes, go through taxes, you kind of delay your process because it's very involved. And so deadlines are missed. And is that kind of the case with applications for services like this?
Well, I mean, so it is complicated. So
yeah,
when you want to apply for, let's say, the SNAP program or Medicaid, these are government sanctioned or government funded programs. Yeah. And the states have some level of autonomy on what they need in order to determine eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of living is different in different states. So there's all sorts of nuance that goes into it that I think we tend to oversimplify and we tend to take for granted.
Yeah.
So for example, if I'm applying for, let's say I'm lost my job and I have, let's say I'm a single mother and I have three children at home, filling out the application can be cumbersome, but that's not what happened in 2008. So people were able to successfully fill out the application. Texas had done a very good job of simplifying the application process, but they just didn't have the capacity of state employees to process that and make the decisions because the demand was so high. And so part of that is operational planning, which it was what they call a black swan event. It was a very difficult thing to forecast. But I also believe that the process, the questions necessary to determine eligibility can be improved. Meaning, for example, in many states, there's an asset test, which basically means what assets do you have? And the thinking is probably correct. Meaning, if I have a lot of money in the bank, I have to disclose what I have in the bank, because they might basically say, well, you use the money that you have in the bank instead of applying for the SNAP program. But some of these rules were developed very early on, meaning a long time ago in the state of Texas, if you were disclosing assets that you would have, one asset could be a burial plot. Maybe you purchased a burial plot for some reason because, well, for some reason, we know the reason why people would purchase a burial plot, but it is considered an asset and you have to disclose that. Now, how do you value a burial plot? I have no idea, but it has to be disclosed as an asset. Another example of that at the time, a long time ago, was, do you have any poultry?
Yeah.
Essentially. And what's the weight of the poultry that you have? Which I sort of have this image of somebody trying to put a chicken on the scale and ask them to hold still. Yeah. But, you know, that is an asset. Yeah. And so now that was a very outdated question. There's probably not a lot of people that have poultry that they could sell, but government is slow and there's a lot of legacy questions that goes on. And if we think about it, how do we simplify the safety net and keep up with the changing times? Because when you ask those questions, there are downstream effects that make it much more expensive to administer large, complicated government programs. Meaning, if a state legislature wants to do an asset test, which makes sense in my opinion, well, let's simplify it a little bit. Because if you do have to check for burial plots and you have to check for poultry, then somewhere on the application, you have to disclose that. Somewhere there's back-end state systems that have to account for that logic, which means you're building business logic into some state eligibility system. And then assuming you do that, you still need to train dozens of employees of state governments to ask those types of questions and know how to answer those types of questions. So yes, sometimes states overcomplicate the application process, which is fixable. And that leads to people that get confused and sort of drop out and they don't even try to apply for these benefits.
And how much of these resources are being underutilized with these communities who are looking for these resources? I don't know if there's any hard numbers out there, but you know, how much of these programs go and the amount of, you know, say if it's money or a certain something else that kind of monetizes it, how much of this is going underutilized?
I don't have the exact figures, but there's a couple different arguments about it. So there are folks that say that there are many more people that qualify for the SNAP program than actually apply. Now, some of that can be attributed to the fact that people don't know about it.
Sure.
Some of that could be attributed to the fact that people found the application process to be cumbersome. But some of it can be contributed to that there's a stigma involved with receiving food stamp benefits, and they don't want to be associated with the stigma. My gut feeling is that the stigma is one of the reasons why there isn't as much utilization, more so than the complication of the process, because many state governments are making it very easy to get enrolled on that's there. So I don't think it's a lack of information with respect to government services.
Sure.
If you think about it, some people, and this is where the idea for Aunt Bertha, which is now called Find Help, came about. And that was, maybe people take a lot of pride in being independent and taking care of themselves and taking care of their families. Maybe they fell on some hard luck and they're running short on rent money this month or food money for whatever reason. They may not want to get enrolled in a large intrusive government program, but they would be totally fine going to a local food pantry and just picking up groceries that sort of help them through. The then question was, well, how do you find out about all of the myriad of social services that might be available to you in your area? And that's the question that I became obsessed with in 2010 and have been ever since.
Yeah. It's so fascinating thinking about where these resources are typically. And I come from a family where we did have to lean on some of these resources, and we found it through local church groups or programs that were connected with schools. So for some reason, because I was a student, we just had access to more resources and we could know about more information. But if we're not in an environment or an ecosystem that feeds us that type of information for us to utilize it in the moment, what do people do? Where do they go find this information if there's not something centralized for them, like a Find Help or, you know, like your church groups or things like that, that, you know, are available for you to even access the knowledge of these resources? What would people typically do, and where and how much information are they missing not being connected to something a little bit more centralized?
That's a great conundrum.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why we exist, is that I think the way that I look at it is we're not here to solve the poverty problem. Our company is not here to solve the poverty problem. Our company is here to solve the information problem, meaning everybody deserves to know what options are available to them in their time of need. And they deserve the dignity of a yes or a no, meaning they apply for the services and they deserve the dignity of a yes or a no. And we believe that very much so. And if we believe if we make information accessible through a great search, and we can help get them the dignity of a yes or no from the agency or the nonprofit that provides that service, then that's our change for the world. Yeah. And in that process, we eliminate anxiety from people that are struggling in that moment. And that's where we want to make a difference in the world. And it's hard to stay focused on that because we're compassionate people. But at the end of the day, you can't accomplish anything great if you don't focus on one thing.
Sure.
And for us, it is that information problem.
Yeah.
And that information is, what are my options? And am I able to get this service?
Yeah.
And so I try not to use healthcare terms or other terms. But at the end of the day, if we solve this information problem, then we're in good shape. And we have, like, collectively as a society, we've solved a lot of challenging information problems. For example, Indeed, which is also based here in Austin, Texas, did an amazing job making jobs accessible to anybody with an internet connection.
Right.
It used to be you wouldn't have any idea if a job opening came open at a company that you admired, but they made it so easy with their service that they fixed a major, major information problem. And of course, e-commerce with Amazon did the same thing.
Right.
And we're just trying to do it in a sector that's been ignored.
Yeah. And thinking about just not even as individuals who are, say, in a moment of need, and whether it's they need food or find themselves in hard times, but also people who are, say, trying to up-level themselves out of their circumstances. There seems to be a lot of programs that help kind of segue people either into certain industries or certain educational programs that help them either get a better job or better opportunity. How much more of those types of programs are we seeing? And is there kind of a push towards educating people about ways that they can improve themselves to almost learn new skills or learn new ways to access income or other resources outside of, you know, immediate needs? What types of programs are out there to kind of serve the long-term needs for individuals and educate them on ways that they can kind of help themselves and up-level themselves and upskill themselves? Are there a lot of programs out there, or are we seeing more now? Yeah, I'm curious on what your experience has been with those.
Well, it is more relevant now probably than in a long time, because our society is changing and it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. Meaning, what do you do when your job is eliminated by technology? So one of the organizations we work with is the state of West Virginia, and it used to be called the Jobs and Hope Program. And in particular, how do you retrain somebody when they are going back into the workplace, whether they were out because they're in the correction system, or maybe they're getting over an addiction, or maybe they just lost their job because a plant closed down or something like that. The gist is that, yes, there's about a million and a half 501c3 nonprofits in the United States in total. But we've looped through and looked at every single one of them over our 13-year history. And I would say that the majority of the programs are tax shelters of some sort. They're family foundations. So poverty fighting or educational related nonprofits, this is a much smaller subset of that million and a half amount. Now, in our system, we've indexed 600,000 plus what we call unique program locations. And these are programs throughout the United States that provide social services. And a subset of those programs are definitely education programs, job training. But even if you do have the skills, you may not have the clothing that you need. Maybe you're self-conscious Sure. about dress clothes. You may not have the childcare that it takes to even go to the interview, or you've never made a resume and you have no idea where to begin. Those types of programs are definitely available and indexed throughout the United States. I haven't looked at the trends in terms of the utilization of those programs. Sure. So in our system, whenever somebody does a search, it's recorded, and we also aggregate and anonymize that data yeah. so that we can see trends over time about, on aggregate, what are people looking for in Texas or in North Dakota or Southern California? And it's interesting. One of the trends that we are seeing is we're adding an enormous amount of users right now. We're adding approximately 1.5 million new distinct users every single month. And if you think about it, that's filling 10, you know, or 15 football stadiums yeah. with 100,000 people every single month. And some of that increase is because of the economy. I mean, we're in the middle of recessionary activity. I'm not an economist, but we're seeing an increase in need every single month. Now, some of it could be that the word's getting around and people are using our system more. But I think because I lived through the financial crisis when I worked at the state, I think part of that is due to there's some real hardship. Now, yeah. lastly, there's cyclical adjustments in the economy and the GDP that affects the need for mm-hmm. social services. But what is happening with knowledge work is pretty incredible. I've shown no interest in ChatGPT over the years sure. because I don't understand it entirely. And I sort of shy away from things sometimes that I don't understand. But the more that I've learned and more that I've seen evidence of what it can produce, that has the potential to really disrupt knowledge work, if you yeah. will. Yeah. Which in some cases that could make the world a much better place. If a human doesn't need to do something that a computer or an AI can do, that may be a good thing. But if it is commercialized in a way, it is possible that it's going to displace a lot of workers. So yeah. your question is more relevant now than ever, meaning how do you retrain the workforce to keep up with changes in rapid technology? Now, we've been through all of this in the past, but we're not done. I mean, yeah. I think we've been living in a renaissance since the internet was started in the 90s or commercialized in the 90s. And sometimes the good times are over and, you know, that rapid expansion may not happen in the future. And so collectively, we come up with more problems. Either way, there needs to be a safety net yeah. that operates because people are always going to have needs.
Yeah. And just to get a little bit more context and to find help, how many organizations are you partnered with? How many communities are you embedded in? And how many individuals have you been able to help up to this time? And what in particular is your focus for the next couple of years that are coming about? With circumstances just being a little bit ambiguous, there's a lot of people, I think, increased in unemployment rate. There's talks about inflation. There's all these external factors that are really kind of bearing a lot of weight on individuals. So I'm curious to you, not only what traction have you seen up to this point, but what in particular are you focused on for the next kind of milestone of Find Help?
I mean, it's a good question. We're nationwide. Mm-hmm. So we just crossed 23 million users, 23 million distinct users, and the rate of growth is very strong. Yeah. We started out just in Austin, Texas in 2011. And in 2014, we reached a milestone of basically ubiquity of programs in every county in the United States. We have really deep customer base. So we have over 550 customers nationwide. Our although findhelp.org is free, and that's part of our public benefit, and we don't monetize the data either. So anybody listening can use findhelp.org to go and find social services and start the application process for you or a family member. That will always be free to use, and you're welcome to check it out, because life throws you a curveball sometimes, and it's going to happen to every single one of us. We all have parents that are aging. We all face scares from diseases. It is something you can't escape. It's the human experience. So feel free to use it or share it. But we have to survive as a business. We are a for-profit benefit corporation, which means that we have a responsibility to be sustainable as a business. So we actually have a product that we sell that is a premium version of our software. And our customers tend to be organizations that tend to hire large groups of social workers. So those customers could be health plans, Medicaid managed care health plans, Medicare Advantage plans, or health systems who work with a lot of social workers, or state governments, city governments, county governments, corrections departments, and K-12 schools. So we have additional integrations with their back-end systems like electronic medical records or case management solutions and things like that. And they pay us a monthly fee. And that's how we sustain as a business. So we're lucky in that we have 600 customers, many nationwide customers like, or getting close to 600, but many nationwide customers like AARP, for example, who serves members that are over a certain age, and they're trying to combat social isolation and loneliness, which is a problem for some of their members. In addition, we work with the American Red Cross that uses our software to help people that are victims of disaster, natural disasters. We work with the American Heart Association and many nationwide organizations that are helping folks, you know, around the United States. So that's how we sustain as a business. Now, where do we go in the long run? Well, we think that if we can solve this information problem that I mentioned earlier, then eventually that data is going to tell us things about the nature of what's actually happening, so that hopefully policymakers can really think about what is the safety net of the future.
Sure.
And I think the safety net of the future is going to look a lot different than the safety net that Lyndon Johnson got passed into law in the 60s. And I'd like to be a part of helping to shape that public policy. Meaning, if we know that certain neighborhoods in Los Angeles are more likely to search for certain types of programs, maybe the mayor or LA County or the state of California, the governor of California, can see that data and allow more flexibility in designing a safety net, a government safety net at least, that gets the right people the right funding at the right time. And that data, that aggregate data, if we are to continue the growth rate of users that we currently have, could be very helpful. If we look at, maybe we can spot trends that might happen, meaning maybe we could look at search data across the United States, and someday in the future, we might be able to tell that a certain organization, faced an economic disaster because maybe a factory shut down in a small town.
Yeah.
How can government officials actually provide a better customer service experience for the citizens? We think we can help with that with the ubiquity of data that we've been able to study and hopefully study in the future. And then, let's say 10 years from now, what does the safety net look like? Well, if you think about it, when somebody goes without, society ends up paying for it eventually. Meaning, if there is somebody who is a veteran and is experiencing homelessness and maybe advanced in age, he's not going to be healthy. And he's going to go to the emergency room at some point, and there will be chronic health conditions that will take place. But how do we sort of set up a safety net such that when we know he's approaching homelessness, is there a mini calculation that takes place, which basically says, well, somebody is willing to fund the rent of this particular homeless veteran, and that somebody could be his health insurance plan, it could be a government agency, it could be an anonymous donor. That should just work. Meaning, if Joe is the person that is experiencing homelessness and he served his country, he's a veteran, then let's make our systems talk together well enough so that we can just fund his rent you know, and take a calculated risk based on that. And the safety net could be individualized to the person based on the risk. Now, if somebody is young and able-bodied and they're experiencing homelessness, they might not have the same safety net as the elderly veteran, sure, you know, that got behind on his rent, because likely in their 20s can find a couch with a buddy. And so it can be that sophisticated, yeah, is my point 10 years from now, because the data is there. It's just getting it in the right hands of the powers that be that can make a decision. Hey, I'm going to pay the rent of this homeless veteran, yeah, because I insure that veteran through my Medicare Advantage plan. And the government allows me to do that because we think that it'll be cheaper to pay his rent for 6 months versus pay the hospital bills that he's inevitably going to get over the next 2 years because he's not getting his insulin medication and he's not getting to his mental health therapy and things like that. So that's what the future looks like. And we're trying to lay the infrastructure for that through the acquisition of users right now through our business model.
I always like this next question. I call it my founder FAQ. So I'm going to hit you with some rapid fire questions and then we'll see where we go. So first question is, what's particularly hard about your job?
It's a good question. It is, you have to just learn how to accept that criticism is going to happen no matter what. Yeah. I think that can be challenging for a founder who, I think all of us in life are just making it up as we go. I think the sure. older I get, I had a conversation with somebody recently. And it was, she stated that she's like, who's in charge? And my point to her, and this was a recent realization, is nobody's in charge. That's what you have to accept, yeah, is that nobody's in charge. The governor's not in charge. There's no,
yeah.
And once you accept that, then life gets a little bit easier. And you realize you just have to do what you can the best you can. And sometimes as a founder, it's hard to, you're going to be criticized no matter what.
Yeah.
You have to make decisions. There are constraints. But I think a founder has to change with the growth of their organization, meaning you don't get to have a balanced life when you're starting a company. We're 13 years in. You don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
And I don't care what anybody says. You don't have that luxury unless you're millionaire and you have unlimited resources. But if you're going to sort of deal with the inflection points of what a growing company is, you can't sustain life without balance. And so you need that for your own mental health. You need that to have a clear enough mind on what it takes to take the business to the next level. And knowing when to turn your mind off to quit thinking about work is also very challenging.
Yeah.
I don't have it figured out. Probably the worst person to ask on that. But some of the things I've been doing more lately is I like to journal, and I journal 3 pages. It's just a stream of consciousness, and it's very therapeutic for me. And then I've also recently started seeing a physical trainer after ignoring my physical health for 13 years. I'm starting to get in shape again, and that helps too. And I was actually talking with my physical trainer this morning, and he said, it's hard to be angry when you're fatigued, because you just want to breathe and to stop the torture.
Right.
And
right.
I just got a kick out of it. And when I do work out in the mornings, I'm in a great mood all day, because it's just like, all right, I'm not going to just worry about stuff. I'm just glad I'm not lifting weights or running right now.
Yeah. Getting the mental clarity from just almost like pure exhaustion is almost a hack in a way to make quick decisions, make them rapidly, and really kind of cut out a lot of the distractions I feel personally, which is the emotive reactions to certain things, right? External factors, decisions people make, or circumstances that I can't control. And, you know, in that fatigue moment, you're almost just like, I can't deal with it. I'm going to move forward and move in a very positive direction. Being that, I think you talked a lot about data and really just accumulating a lot of data to understand what resources people need, what information are they seeking out, who can actually provide that. What has like the recent changes in technology allowed you in terms of accumulating a large pool of data? And then actually what's changed in terms of the speed to service that you've seen being that you can kind of predictively, based on what people are looking at or are searching for, find them the resources that they need? What have you seen in that increase in speed for individuals seeking services to actually get them when connected through a platform like yours and having technology kind of do the work?
Oh, That's a great question. And it's only going to get faster in every aspect of life, meaning, I mean, in the 90s, I used to use Amazon in college because the search. So I went to Indiana University where I graduated, and I would need a book, and I tried to go to the library to find it, and it was, the search was terrible. And so I would get on Amazon, find the book because the search was so much better, and then not buy the book. And then I'd have more details, and then I could go to the library and get the book. Right. So I didn't have a laptop at the time, but I would, in my apartment, I would do it. And so, but to think 23 years later, I graduated in college in 2000, but 23 years later, I could be shaving and I could order more shaving cream. It'll be put in my garage the next day. I mean, that's outstanding. Yeah. Progress in 23 years is not a long time. So the workflow, the rapid acceleration of workflow is only going to get more rapid. And that's physical goods with planes and everything like that. In our world, it's different, right? But it'll accelerate completely. Our first goal through the iteration of our business was, you know, one search, all programs. Let's just let people see programs. And we've yet to really add intelligence behind our workflows. Yeah. But for example, let's say somebody applied, but this is what the future is going to look like here. Let's say somebody applied for social services, specifically an affordable housing program, and they got a rejection from that affordable housing program because, you know, there just wasn't capacity at the time. What if somebody moved out of that complex 2 months later? Well, guess what? Somebody, that person that applied and got rejected 2 months ago might be a perfect fit.
Yeah.
What if we sent an alert immediately that, hey, a unit just opened up. You should reactivate your application or apply again. Yeah. So that people have, it's an information problem, just like I mentioned before. And what if we could also more proactively basically state that we know you just got out of prison. We have studied the data enough to say that this particular nonprofit does a great job helping people with the emotional side of reintegrating back into society.
Yeah.
We, in the future, I hope we can tell the efficacy of and the effectiveness of nonprofits based on the outcomes of the people that they serve. So it could be that the data tells you that this particular nonprofit in this particular community, something's happening there because when somebody engages with that nonprofit, their lives get better.
Yeah.
Meaning their income goes up, they're less sick. The information about their income and their health, it's all over the place.
Sure.
That information can be studied, but what causes that inflection point? And I think in the future, you're going to be able to isolate that to specific organizations and maybe even to specific social workers that figure out how to connect to people. And what if we could learn from that social worker and learn from that organization, and they are teaching others how to be that effective? So I'm excited about sort of the next phase, because if we've solved the search problem, that's a great problem to solve. Just like in the 90s, I could find any book in the world better than the IU library, which was probably much better funded than Amazon in the 90s.
Yeah.
And that's a good problem to solve. But where you really start to change lives is that you add that intelligence on top of that.
Yeah.
But you need to earn their trust as users before, just like I didn't give Amazon much money in the 90s, but I trusted them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That trusted delivery to service kind of concept is hard to capture. And a lot of times it's just with the consistency of that experience being returnable and something that doesn't change and does kind of help with the outcomes that you're looking for. I always like to ask this question because I love how founders extract knowledge from anything that they ingest. Whether it was early in your career or now, what books or people have been the most or even ideally the most influential or most impactful in your life? Any books or people kind of come to mind?
So that's a great question. I'll rapidly go through The Catcher in the Rye. I read as an adult in my 20s. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have read it in high school. I was pretty bitter as a kid and sarcastic. And that was a great book in that it just sort of lightened me up a little bit.
Yeah.
And I read it every few years from time to time. I gave it to my niece. She and I are a lot alike, but she wasn't that interested. I love How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think that should be required reading by anybody. It's Timeless by Dale Carnegie. From business perspective, and this is sort of an also a classic, is Good to Great. It just does a good job of articulating what it takes to be a successful business. And that is also timeless. My key point from Good to Great is, what is your focus? What could you be best in the world at that you enjoy doing and that is sustainable? So those are just some of the books I'm always reading. As I mentioned, I finally buy a lot of books from Amazon and I don't always read them, but we have a library here in the office, which I like to just go on buying book sprees and put them in the library. But I also love reading biographies. One is the Wright brothers. And that was outstanding because when you read a good biography, you realize that they were not superhuman. They just tried and they had that singularity of focus.
Yeah.
And the last line in that book, I'm not going to give it away, is amazing. So I'm forgetting the author, but it's the Wright brothers, a famous biographer. And another one that I love is The Boys in the Boat.
Yeah.
It was a biography of the crew team, University of Washington crew team, that won the Olympics in 1936 in Germany. They were a very poor group of guys, and they just had such great cohesion, and they went and won the gold medal. And that was a beautiful book as well, where the author found a member of the team that was still alive, and he was very coherent, but he was basically on his deathbed. Yeah. But his mind was so sharp and he just heard all the stories. And it's a beautiful book that I highly recommend. That book calmed me down a little bit too, because it talked about his life and the trouble that he had. And then after the Olympics, he worked at Boeing for many years and great relationships. And I love sort of the underdog story, which is good. People, too many to number along the way, but some of the investors that we work with, I've been lucky to get to know them, and they're very kind and an ear that we can go to, and really have built good, strong friendships with them. And my coach, I'm lucky to work with a coach, Peter Redding, who I met in 2014 through a fellowship that I was in. And he took me on pro bono for many years, and he has really helped be a voice to talk me through the hardest decisions. The thing is about getting a coach is that they're dedicated to you and not the business. And as a CEO, you don't always have people to talk to. Can't share your fears with employees because you might freak them out.
Yeah.
You can't always share your fears with investors because they might lose confidence in you maybe. But a coach is there who cares about you. And my coach has said, Aaron, if you want to go to the woods and write a best-selling novel, I'm here for you. And that trust that you develop with a coach, I would highly recommend, because sustaining a business and at scale and sticking with it for decades, in our case, 13 years so far, and getting to profitability is hard. And it doesn't get easier over time.
Right.
And you have to find those things that motivate you. And books and conversations with mentors are a huge part of survival.
Yeah. Last little bit. I know we're at the end of the show here, and I always want to make sure we didn't leave anything on the table. Is there any question I didn't ask you that I should have, or anything you'd want to mention that you haven't yet?
Well, I think what I would say is that I really believe that the private sector has a role in recreating the American safety net.
Mm.
I don't see it as a problem of government. And I actually don't think it's fair to people who are struggling to have an attitude. So for those of us that have opinions about the safety net, to think that government should just solve it is a disservice to the people that are struggling.
Yeah.
To be so simple about one of the most complicated problems in the world, which is alleviating poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should really have a conversation of what does a re-envisioned safety net look like? One with that can be operated with dignity and ease. And it's quite ignorant, and I'm being a little bold in saying that, to say that, well, that's government's problem, or we should just give more money, and it's ridiculous and it's untrue, because per capita, we spend an enormous amount of money helping people in need, but I think as a country, we do it poorly.
Yeah.
But if you embrace the private sector and the things that are good about the private sector, and you find the motivations of solving a particular problem, and rather than build your own software, work with governments, hire private sector vendors to work with governments, get creative about what the future looks like and embrace the messiness. Yeah. And in order to build the safety net of the future, we need more people to go into government. We need more people to care about the safety net and get off Twitter and get off Facebook and get off TikTok and quit complaining. And your little like for somebody's meme did nothing better for the world, but go spend your career fixing the safety net. And if we do that, then we can have a safety net of the future. But what it means is that if you go spend your career fixing the safety net, you may not make as much money. You may not get as much short-term recognition, but you will have a meaningful career. Yeah. And that matters as you get older in life, is knowing that on a Friday night, when you close your laptop, you did something special, you made a difference, and there's nothing more rewarding than that. So I would just, to close out, just encourage you to, listeners, to really think about, you know, why can't the safety net look like things that happen in other sectors? Why can't it be more efficient? And the answer is because nobody's done it yet. And that's because nobody's in charge.
Yeah.
So that would be my closing thoughts.
Amazing, Aaron. It's been such a pleasure learning about your early career and kind of the early iterations of Find Help, but now kind of where you're leading to and really tackling the information problem to get people the resources that they need, but also to enable them to do it more quickly, more efficiently, more effectively. It's been such an incredible time. And last little bit is, where can we find you? Where can we support you as a founder? Give us your LinkedIns, your websites, your emails, whatever works for people to get in touch. We're a big fan and maybe even want to get involved in Find Help.
Sure. Yeah. So I try to stay off social media, but I am on LinkedIn. So you can just search my name and I'll come up. If anybody wants to email me, my email is egray@findhelp.com. And I live in Austin. And if you're interested in working with us, we're always looking for good people. And if I can be helpful in any way, find me on LinkedIn and you can track me down easily.
I love that. Aaron, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. I hope you enjoyed yourself today on Behind Company Lines, and thank you again for being on the show.
Nice to meet you, Julian, and I really appreciate the experience.